From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day, despite the fact that I know you were just enormously looking forward to the next Democratic debate, which was scheduled for January 14th. It is going to be postponed. Maybe. Well, it's unclear. It's uncertain. Why? It's not apparently because of the crisis in Iran. The president has said that we're going to be finding out tomorrow at some point more specifics about the intelligence behind his decision to take out General Soleimani. But it is because of the ongoing impeachment, where Mitch McConnell is now saying, you know, okay, Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to bring the impeachment over here. We'll start the trial anyway. And he says he has the votes to do it. We shall see. And we are now less than a month away from the Iowa caucuses. The most recent polling showed a three-way tie for the lead in Iowa, a tie between Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg, with Elizabeth Warren well behind. To talk about the race and a column, and it's a very smart column, it seems to me, that he wrote, let me welcome back to the show my friend Tim Egan, who is a regular contributor to the New York Times. And he has a column about one term, Joe. He is also the author of the recent bestseller, a bestseller about a pilgrimage to eternity from Canterbury to Rome in search of a faith. And it is a very personal book about Tim Egan's own reconnection with a Catholic tradition in which he was raised. Tim, congratulations again on the book, and thanks for the column. And what do you think? Do you think a one-term Joe is the winning ticket for Democrats?
Yeah. So it's great to be back with you as well, Michael, and thank you for having me, and thanks for the kind words on pilgrimage. Yeah, I think, you know, they've already signaled, the Biden camp has signaled that they would be willing to just, if he were to get elected, to just serve one term. He can't say that publicly, and when he was asked about that in the debate, because it, you know, condemns him to one-term lame duck status. But I think it's a winning call, because voters, the number one thing you see in all the polling across the board is that voters are exhausted. They're beaten down. They can hardly, you know, they lift their eyes half-lidedly while they read the news. They want some sort of a national restorative. They want something that just gives them a break and a rest. And by signaling that you would only do one term, that you would be sort of a caretaker, which sounds like a pejorative, I think it helps Biden get votes beyond the base.
Yeah, and doesn't it also call enormous attention to who you pick as a running mate? I mean, because if you're only going to serve one term, and that's going to be the case anyway for a lot of these superannuated candidates, lots of them, because look, the actuarial tables say Joe Biden would be 78 when he became president. Is that right?
Yeah, 77 on election day, 78 on the day he was inaugurated. And Trump, of course, is not far behind him at 74. Bernie Sanders would be 79. So, you know, we have a real septenarian struggle here.
Yeah, and by the way, Elizabeth Warren, 71 when she was inaugurated.
Correct, correct. So, you know, the interesting thing now, and you mentioned it in your introduction, we've had a year and change to really talk about the highs and lows, and mostly just nonsense and gas. And now people are going to start voting a month from today in the Iowa caucus. And you mentioned that poll that shows basically a three-way tie. To me, the interesting thing, that was a CBS poll, I believe. To me, the interesting thing in that poll was the moderates poll more than the lefties in that. If you combine Buttigieg's vote, Biden's vote,
and Amy Klobuchar.
And Amy Klobuchar.
She gets 7% in that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're more than Warren and Sanders combined. So, I mean, that marks somewhat of a shift. And you mentioned the vice president as well. I'm not sure the left wing would go along with a Biden nomination unless he picks a progressive and a young progressive at his VP, which would probably quiet them. I don't know. The other alternative, and we can talk about this too, is that we may just have a convention that goes to, you know, half a dozen votes. We may not have an answer. Sanders looks pretty strong after going into Super Tuesday.
Those are sentences that I never expected to hear. Sanders looks pretty strong. I mean, yeah. He looks pretty frail to me. But again, you saw the footage of him playing basketball and things like that.
You know, he was a miler in high school, and as was I.
Okay.
I like to think I have an affinity for old guys who can still run. You know, look, I'm not a Sanders supporter. I'm an opinion columnist, by the way, for all your listeners. I'm no longer on the news side, so I'm voicing my opinion here as a columnist. I'm not a Sanders supporter. I think, you know, they're talking about Medicare for All, which doesn't have a hair's chance of ever getting out of Congress, when they should be talking about the fight against, you know, protecting pre-existing conditions and the ACA. So, I mean, Sanders, but he has a passionate base that's damn well near 40% of the Democrats, and they are not going to desert him. So,
okay, here is one of the things that I saw in reaction to that CBS poll that we've been talking about, which is pretty shocking because it shows that Buttigieg and Biden and Sanders are all well ahead of Elizabeth Warren. Here's the rumor of the day, okay? The rumor of the day is Elizabeth Warren does not do well in Iowa, that she finishes in fourth or maybe even fifth place if Amy Klobuchar goes ahead of Elizabeth Warren. And then she goes to New Hampshire, where she has to win because right next door to Massachusetts, she loses to Bernie and maybe others in New Hampshire. And then at that point, Bernie and Elizabeth make a deal because Bernie is the real one-term candidate. If you become president at 89, I mean, you're shot at a second turn. A 79, pardon me. Yeah. But still, a 79-year-old, when you're taking the oath of office, that means he would be, if my math is correct, 83 when he's running for re-election.
Right. And still shouting at us. You know,
why are you shouting? I don't understand. What's bothering you so much?
Yeah, I like the Saturday Night Live interview. But, yeah, that's a great here. They've had a non-aggression pact, as your listeners probably know. Warren and Sanders have just refused to attack each other. And you would think on the surface or beneath the surface, boy, one of these people has to kill the other so that they can get the combined progressive vote. But they've had a non-aggression pact. The question has been, when will that thing either fall away or, as you just mentioned, will they combine forces somehow?
Because this actually reminds me of Israeli politics. In other words, one of the parties in Israel, the Blue and White Party, which is won two ties in a row with the ruling Likud party, they had a deal there that they would have the leader of that party, Benny Gantz, served the first 2 years as prime minister, and then they would go to Yair Lapid, who was a more controversial member of the party, and he would serve the second 2 years. Now, I'm not saying that anything like that happens, but if you install Elizabeth Warren as a running mate for Bernie before the convention, and the convention chooses, wouldn't that be a very formidable link? Because if you add up Elizabeth and Bernie together in terms of their national polling, it's not quite a majority, but it's getting close, isn't it?
It's pretty damn near close. It's pretty close to 50%. But here's the thing, and I want, you know, I think you understand this. Once you get out of Iowa and New Hampshire, and just let me say something about New Hampshire for one moment, Warren is not necessarily very popular in her home state of Massachusetts. She doesn't poll that well. I was there last summer in a dinner among a bunch of libs, like 12 people, and I asked how many of them would go for Warren for president. Not a single one of them raised their hand. And so she doesn't really do that well in neighboring New Hampshire. It's sort of a myth because it's the neighboring state. So she can lose that. But once we get beyond that and we get to Super Tuesday, which is March 3rd, one-third of the United States, or at least states representing one-third of the population, will vote. And it's a heavily African-American people of color vote. And Biden cleans up among those folks. And he still... So, I mean, the progressive vote is near 50%, but it doesn't necessarily poll well among people of color. I mean, that's where Biden is really, really strong. He has this unusual coalition in that no one else has it of disaffected whites and people of color. No other candidate can boast that.
1-800-955-1776, our phone number. I'm talking to Tim Egan, who is an opinion columnist for the New York Times. He is also a National Book Award winner. And his new book is just a great read, and it's deeply moving and actually inspiring, ultimately. It's called A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. And I mention your book right now because Joe Biden is talking about America in general being in search of a faith. He has a column that just appeared in the Des Moines Register and is now covered in USA Today. And the column is, the headline they use, which is pretty fair this time, is "Worse Than Even His Policies, Donald Trump is Destroying America's Soul." And just to give you a flavor, Tim, after sketching out some of his policy disagreements with President Trump, the former vice president writes, "Worse somehow than his policy failures has been the damage he has done to the source of our nation, to the soul of our nation. He fans the flames of hate groups at home. He embraces murderous dictators abroad. He rips children from their mother's arms at our border. He pressures foreign nations to interfere in our elections. Every day, his endless spigot of unhinged lies, thoughtless cruelties, and petty complaints embarrasses his office and degrades our national character. Is it any wonder that the once unimaginable sight of allied world leaders mocking and laughing at the American president has now become routine?" An effective line for the vice president to take?
You know, he's been saying that since the start. I mean, if you follow this campaign, you know that there's been one consistent Biden theme. He doesn't talk about policies, although he has plenty of them. He doesn't talk about being the third term of Obama, although that's somewhat implied. What he talks about is the, quote, soul of America. And it appeals to a lot of folks. Now, remember, Biden came out of blue-collar Catholicism. He's a son of Scranton. He's never left the Catholic Church. He does very well among Catholics, and Catholics are sort of up for grabs in this coming vote. They went narrowly for Hillary last time, but they went for Reagan before that. So when he talks about the soul of America being at stake, it really touches a lot of chords with a lot of folks.
But do you think that some of Joe Biden's moves to the left have had any impact? I mean, for instance, he once supported the Hyde Amendment, which didn't ban any abortions. It prohibited federal funding for abortions. Now he's in favor of federal funding for abortions. That hasn't shaken any of his blue-collar Catholic support?
I'd have to dial down on some of the polling to say that. But here's the problem with all primary processes. They do take you out of the middle lane and move you to the side of your party. And Biden's done that as well. You know, he's kept his Catholic credentials. I mean, you don't hear people talking about him as somehow a traitor to his faith or anything like that, despite the movement on abortion. He's been fairly consistent on that, except for things like the Hyde Amendment. But he's been fairly consistent on being pro-choice like that. But to get back to my point on the, if I could, just on the one-term part of it, again, the political pros think it's crazy. It's heretical. But I think it would be a pretty good play because you're just signaling that, look, we just want to stop the noise, stop the exhaustion, restore insanity, and, as he said in that column, bring back the soul of America. So I think getting there is going to be another thing. Another person we didn't talk about who actually is moving in the polls is former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's dropped a ton of money, and he just announced today he's going to put a Super Bowl ad up that's going to cost him $10 million. Some people say it's just to troll Trump, but he's starting to move in the polls. As you know, he's decided not to compete in the first four primaries, though, either.
Yeah, and the last candidate to try that was Rudy Giuliani, and that didn't go very well. You remember that?
I got one delegate. Yeah, I wrote a column called Goodbye Rudy Tuesdays.
Right. Well, that's a great title. Okay, now, you're a historian, and again, I've loved your books about history, but you probably know we have two presidents who were elected who had pledged at the beginning they would serve only one term, and they had kind of mixed results. You remember which two?
Now you're stumping me on this.
Okay, it's James K. Polk.
Uh-huh.
And the thing about Polk is he said, I'm only going to serve one term. And then he completed in that one term all four of the major promises he made, which is one of the reasons he gets fairly okay ratings from most historians. The other president who pledged to only serve one term was Rutherford B. Hayes, and the reason he made that pledge is because, well, his election was extremely controversial. It was known as Rutherfraud because it was a disputed election. In any event, it's very, very rare. But I think that in this situation, particularly when you're talking about age potentially being an issue, and you're talking about Michael Bloomberg putting all this money into the campaign. He's another guy. He's 78.
Yes.
Joe Biden.
But looks 76.
Oh, there you go. Do you have any idea if Joe Biden is the nominee, how much money Trump will spend? And Trump has $140 million banked up, ready to go?
Yeah, just sitting there right now. And they're doing a lot of stuff on social media, which is, you can get tons of bang for your buck.
And he's going to have all this money, and he's going to attack Joe Biden as Sleepy Joe. He's going to imply that Joe Biden is senile. Why doesn't that work for the president?
Or he's corrupt too. He's going to say that he's corrupt because
Hunter. And we're going to know all about every failing, and there are plenty of them Hunter Biden has ever perpetrated, right?
Yeah, exactly. But let me go back to your earlier thing about how rare one-termers are. And thank you. I yield to no one but you in your knowledge of facts on presidents. By the way, the reason the British flag doesn't fly over the Pacific Northwest is largely because of President Polk.
Absolutely right.
And by British Columbia, just to the north of us, the Union Jack did fly for a while over there. So, no, the difference is what's rare still is to have a president that age. And that's the glaring fact that stares us in the face, is that you're talking about breaking totally new ground, even in an era when all lives have been extended. So, and on the money front, I mean, it looks right now that the Democrats are just going to get their butts kicked because there's so much dough out there. I wonder, this to me is the big question for the two billionaires in the race, Steyer and Bloomberg. Bloomberg now is spending will expend in excess of $200 million. And that was a presidential campaign just 4 years ago, a complete campaign, the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, when Bob Dole ran, the whole thing cost $20 million. So I
remember Steve Forbes ran. He spent $26 million of his own money.
And
didn't win the nomination, but Bloomberg, $200 million? Unbelievable. Go ahead.
Now,
finish
the question
the point.
Is, will he spend that amount or more, or will Steyer spend that amount or more in independent financing to attack Trump, to counter? If they want to do their civic duty, if they feel that way, that would be a good use of their money right now. And I think most Democrats don't mind them spending their money now because their ads, though they promote their candidates, they're genuine. Generally target Trump. And one more thing on this. I spent a lot of time in Montana where I still have family and where my family is from on my mother's side. And because it's a small state, they buy up every single ad, a year in advance, every single ad space, I'm sorry. And so in a Senate race here, you just get bombarded 24/7. And it doesn't really move the needle. I mean, you look at where people are, if they're known quantities like John Tester, the senator from Montana, he just gets hammered. You can't go in Montana during election season and not see an ad every 5 minutes. And it generally doesn't move the needle. So I'm somewhat skeptical about the power of those things, although, of course, social media is a different beast entirely.
Okay. And we're speaking to Tim Egan. Tim's new book, which is called A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. And it describes his own walking that extensive path. Now, the question is, if you know the map, how do you get from Canterbury to Rome on foot? Well, you have to read the book and find out. Tim Egan, always great to speak to you. Happy New Year. May it be a good year for all of us, and above all, a great year for our country. And what does that mean in terms of confronting deaths of despair, which are a gigantic American problem, particularly despair for young people and for cops? We will get to that and more coming up on The Medved Show.
What a guy. There is a decent, honorable man.
Michael Medved.
That man has more integrity in his little finger than most people have in their whole body.
on the Michael Medved show, talking about one of the vulnerabilities that Joe Biden faces, not so much in the primary campaign, because I do think that Tim Egan was talking about the sort of peace treaty or the non-aggression pact between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Democrats have been very reluctant to go after Uncle Joe. And I think part of the reason for that is because of what happened to Kamala Harris. You remember her big moment where she gained in the polls briefly was when she attacked Joe Biden over the dumbest issue imaginable. I mean, remember she attacked him over forced busing. And forced busing was universally unpopular when it happened. Unpopular among Democrats, unpopular among black people. Because it basically was bureaucrats telling you where you had to go to school, far away from your home, sometimes riding an hour on a bus each way. In any event, it didn't work out so well for Kamala Harris when she went after Joe Biden. And so people have been easy on him. But he is a gaffe machine. He does stumble over words. And Tim Egan makes a point in his column about one-term Joe. The president of the United States does too, kind of, sort of. Well, more than kind of, sort of. He does. Joe Biden had another one today talking about the Iran parliament. Listen.
The Iran parliament voted to eject all Americans and coalition forces from the country.
Okay, it's a pretty bad gaffe because there are no Americans, not even diplomats, in Iran. They were ejected in 1979, and we haven't been back. We don't have an embassy in Tehran. Probably a good thing because they probably would occupy it or seize it or blow it up or something like that if we did. Look, wouldn't it be wonderful if at the end of President Trump's term, if we could reestablish diplomatic relationships with Iran? I don't think that will happen unless there is a serious regime change, or at least a change of regime thinking in Iran. Biden also commented regarding Iran on what he believes the president should do next.
While I don't expect Donald Trump to listen to me, I hope he'll listen to those around him who understand the gravity of the threats we now face. He should take the necessary steps to protect our forces and ensure the security of our diplomats, civilians, and overseas facilities, not just in the Middle East, but anywhere that Iran might be able to strike. He should ensure the federal authorities are working with state and local governments and private institutions to guard against heightened risk of cyber attacks. He should stop tweeting so he doesn't box us in with these threats such that only options left for Iran are increasingly damaging strikes and counterstrikes. And he should immediately, and I hope he's doing this now, but I've heard none of it, he should be immediately reaching out to our European partners and others and send private signals of deterrence and de-escalation to Iran and find a way to avoid the onrush of war. And the best way to do that, of course, would be for President Trump to rejoin the Iran deal and build on it. If Iran moves back in compliance with the obligations and reestablishes international consensus about how to confront these threats in Iran, we'll be much, much better off. The only way out of this crisis is through diplomacy. Clear-eyed, hard-nosed diplomacy grounded in a strategy that's not about one-off decisions and one-upsmanship. Diplomacy that's designed to de-escalate the crisis, protect our people, and secure our regional interests, including our counter-ISIS campaign. No one wants war, but it's going to take hard work to make sure we don't end up there by accident.
I actually think that was one of the more effective statements on foreign policy that Joe Biden has made in the campaign so far. And the truth of the matter is, I think that is what the Trump administration is likely to do. And you can say, wow, no, Trump will never rejoin the nuclear deal with Iran. Sure he would. If he got a better deal. And he would say, as he did with, remember how much President Trump attacked NAFTA? And then one of the big successes for the Trump administration was renegotiating NAFTA. People who are experts in foreign trade deals will tell you this deal is updated. It is more up to date. It includes more recent developments, but it's not substantially different. It's not like wildly different. Oh, NAFTA was such a nightmare and this is such a blessing. This is a blessing. It's a good trade deal. And by the way, it is about to be confirmed finally by the Congress of the United States. And that's a good thing. And President Trump can say, just as he said, NAFTA was the worst deal in the history of the world. No country has ever made a worse deal than NAFTA. NAFTA was the, and he also says this is the best deal anyone's ever made. It's the most. He could say the same thing about a new nuclear deal with Iran. But one of the things about this situation that we see is how very important it is to avoid Iran developing nuclear weapons. It also puts in perspective some of the fact that they are taking America maybe a bit more seriously after the strike against Soleimani. Why? Because they have not even completely withdrawn from the nuclear deal, which still applies to the Europeans. They clearly want these sanctions to end. Their economy is a mess right now. And if there is some kind of deal with Iran, which I think Mike Pompeo is eager to negotiate, then it could be a positive development. There's also, I think, a great fear in America that we might experience from Iran some kind of wildly disproportionate response. In other words, we took out this general who is now being hailed as a beloved martyr and, of course, being praised by many in the American press as a military genius. He was a brilliant and inspiring figure. Honest to goodness, a year from now, no one will remember Qasem Soleimani. Yes, I know there are people in Iran who will remember him. But around the world, forget about it. But one of the things that you can learn from in Iranian history is there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal today. It's very informative. It's well done. It's by Drew Hinshaw in Dubai and Felicia Schwartz in Tel Aviv. It says, a look at the history of Iranian reprisals shows how difficult it will be to predict how, when, and where Iran might fight back in response to the drone attack that killed Major General Qasem Soleimani, head of Iran's Quds Force. In January 2012, unknown assassins killed a nuclear chemist in Tehran, the fourth such Iranian scientist, in quotes, to be slain in 2 years. Israel was widely believed to be behind the killings, although it has never confirmed its involvement and doesn't generally comment publicly on such operations. After the killing of the nuclear scientist, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, promised to, quote, punish the perpetrators of these heinous crimes, with Iranian media suggesting Iran could strike officials and military commanders in Israel. They never did. What did they do in response? I'll tell you, because it might give some indication of what happens next. We will be right back on The Medved Show. 1-800-955-1776. On the Michael Medved Show, talking a little bit about the United States on guard properly right now for potential reprisals from Iran for the killing of General Soleimani. And question being, what can we learn from past Iranian reprisals? We'll get to your calls in just a moment. I wanted to just complete this story because in 2012, there was a clear plan to deal with potential Iranian reprisals against Israel and or the United States. And this is based on the killing of a series of nuclear scientists, which, and I don't know, they were just, a lot of those killings were people seeing cars blowing up and being shot from passing motorcycles. And they were fairly professional takeouts of people who were working on the Iran nuclear program. And apparently it set back the nuclear program a great deal. In any event, the Ayatollah said, we're going to punish the perpetrators of these heinous crimes. And he suggested that he could strike officials and military commanders in Israel itself. And in Congress in January of 2012, which is when this was taking place, the director of national intelligence at the time, who was James Clapper, this is under Obama, of course, warned that Iran increasingly was willing to strike on American soil. So where did they strike? Well, first of all, they struck fairly quickly after that. They struck a month later. When the expected retaliation came in February 2012, it didn't hit any of the countries where U.S. and Israeli officials had most anticipated. Instead, bomb attacks targeted Israeli diplomats in Georgia, in India, and in Thailand, wounding nine across thousands of miles within 24 hours. Later that year, another bomb killed five Israeli tourists, civilians, on a bus trip through Bulgaria. In each case, Iran denied involvement. Israeli officials have said they thwarted other possible retaliatory attacks. I know that the attack in Bulgaria is widely, they even arrested people. Of course, Iran was responsible for that. In 1992, and this goes back, but it's the same regime, and Soleimani was still involved in the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps. In 1992, the Israel Defense Forces killed Abbas al-Musawi, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. Hezbollah at that point had killed hundreds of Israeli civilians. The retaliation that followed came a month later, but thousands of miles away. In Buenos Aires, where a Shiite militant drove a bomb-laden pickup truck through the gates of the Israeli embassy, the attack killed 29 civilians and flattened a nearby school and destroyed a Catholic church in what Hezbollah said was revenge for its leader's death. 2 years later, a repeat attack at a nearby Jewish community center killed 85 civilians, including a bunch of preschoolers. The combined attacks inflamed public opinion against Hezbollah. Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, who's now known as Francis, the Pope of Rome, signed a document demanding justice for the victims, and Argentine prosecutors later issued an arrest warrant for Hezbollah's military chief, Umad Mignaya. The next year, Mr. Mignaya was leaving a party in the Syrian capital of Damascus when a bomb exploded. General Soleimani, who had been with him days earlier, visited the grave. Again, Hezbollah declared it would take revenge. That revenge never came. Thank God. Let's go to Bob in Bothell, Washington. Bob, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
Hey, Michael. So I would definitely agree we do not want to get involved in another protracted war in the Middle East, but in terms of leverage, Iranians, should they declare war on the United States, and should we, for lack of a better term, accept, doesn't that make all of their nuclear development sites legitimate military targets?
100%. And this is why I am fairly confident that this is going to be remembered historically as a good move and the right move for President Trump and for the United States of America. Because with all of the media hysteria about, oh, what a military genius Soleimani was, and he was such an inspiring figure, and then you see all these crowds in Tehran, it kind of makes you forget about what a loser country Iran has become under, sorry, but it is, under the mullahs. And in terms of a war between the United States of America and Iran, are you kidding me? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And one thing about Iranians is it's a loser country right now because of this evil government they have. But Iranians are smart, and they understand this. The same idea that they didn't try any further attacks or, quote, revenge on Israel after the death of Mughniyeh. I think what it indicates is that they probably will do something and blow up something. But in terms of pushing us into a full war, that is not something that would go well for Iran. And you're right. Their nuclear developments, their oil transport facilities, they're all juicy targets. I appreciate your call. Coming up, there's a real question about young Americans killing themselves. A part of this, by the way, involves something that was supposed to be a great blessing for Americans and make us all safer and happier and healthier, which was legalized pot. There's all kinds of mounting evidence and literally articles every day, if you look for them, about how dangerous weed really is. And here's a headline in USA Today, marijuana psychosis treatment, tough to find for young people. And it's one of the contributing factors to young people having these deaths of despair that are now the second leading cause of death. And also, we're going to be talking to a wife of a police officer who has been working on the problem with 238 cops last year, 2019, who took their own lives. 130 who died in the line of duty, who were killed by bad guys. And that is an extraordinary fact that needs attention. There's also a new city that is vying for murder capital of the world. I mean, murder capital of the world. It is an unbelievable number. I just saw it. It is mind-blowing. You know why? Because that murder capital of the world is literally 20 miles away, 20 miles away from one of the safest big cities on planet Earth. How could it be? And the difference in terms of the number of murders, it's like 100 to 1. Why does that happen? We will get to that and more coming up on the Michael Medved Show. There's also gigantic political news. It's an earthquake. Julian Castro, as you know, has given up his campaign. He's made an endorsement. Wow. Is he going to bring with him the dozens of people who had committed themselves to the Julian Castro dream to bring reproductive justice?
I believe in reproductive justice.
To transgendered women? We will tell you about the big Julian Castro endorsement. In fact, maybe we'll let him speak for himself. In this greatest nation on God's green earth.